I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Patrick Lane joins me again. He's just published his second novel, Deep River Night. It's gotten great reviews for its rich imagery and exquisite writing that the distinguished writer and poet has been regarded for in a career that spanned over 40 years. The book explores numerous themes, including violence, evil, the past, and the challenge of memory. Art Kenning is a first aid man in a sawmill in the interior of British Columbia. He's a veteran who has to contend with what we'd call PTSD now, and he's re-traumatized by incidents from his time during World War II. Mr. Lane evokes the time he writes about, the post-war period, mid-20th century, with evocative emotion. I'll get Patrick to tell us about this book. It's his second novel. He was first on this show nearly 10 years ago when his first novel, Red Dog, Red Dog, was published. That book was a finalist for Amazon.ca Books in Canada First Novel Award, the Rogers Writers Trust Fiction Prize, the Ethel Wilson Fiction Prize, and was longlisted for the Giller Prize. He was on nearly 4 years ago when his poetry collection Washita was published. He is one of Canada's preeminent poets, having published more than 25 volumes of poetry. His memoir, There Is a Season, was critically acclaimed. He has a slew of honorary degrees from across the country. This new book is published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Patrick Lane. Mr. Lane, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to hear your voice. It's been a while.
Yeah, and you know, I understand that it hasn't been altogether pleasant for you these last several months.
Well, actually, it hasn't been too terribly pleasant for about the last couple of years. I've had an ongoing condition of that sort of set me back a lot, but I think the doctors, many of whom are at one point I had a dozen of them, but now it's down to about four.
Uh-huh.
They've sort of got it generally figured out what I have, so things are getting a little better.
Lorna's well?
Yeah, Lorna's very, very well. She's a bundle of energy, and she's traveling all over the world and having just the busiest time in her life. She's entering her 70s, and she's ready to rock and roll.
So. This book, as I told you before we started, I'm about say a quarter through it, and I'm enjoying it a great deal, even though it's not altogether pleasant as well. I mean, it's a dark sort of setting, isn't it?
Well, again, let me talk about the book a little bit. What I initially planned on doing at one point 7 years ago, seven and a half years ago now, was writing a murder mystery. I thought, well, why don't I write a book that can actually make some money rather than a literary work?
Right.
And so I set out to do that and promptly turned around and wrote another literary work with a mystery at the heart of it, which excited me that I could manage to sort of hold off revealing the solution to the mystery until the very end of the book, which is what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But what I want to do explore more than anything, Joe, was a time in my own life when I used to work up north in central British Columbia, northern British Columbia, as a first aid man when I was a very young man. I was in my late teens, early 20s when I became a first aid man, largely to make the extra 25 cents an hour, which, you know, made a big difference in terms of my the money I was earning to support my family.
Uh-huh.
25 cents an hour sounds like a minuscule amount of money, but back in those days, 25 cents made a big difference between $1.35 and $1.60, say,
yeah,
an hour. So I wanted to explore that world, and I wanted to explore the world of the working class people of small town, northern village that's owned and operated, run and controlled and completely dominated by a small, powerful industry, which in British Columbia we call logging and lumber.
Hmm.
And it's different now, of course, the huge towns now, everything's consolidated and centralized and mechanized. But in those days it was a hard, clabber, working class life, and it was tough. And men were tough because most of the men who ran those towns and worked in those towns had come out of the Second World War. And they were the men who educated me in what it was to be a man.
Yeah.
And it was that was where the book turned towards, was examining those kinds of people, their lives, what happened to them, and how they handled things. You know, when there was no police, I've worked in towns where there was no police, Joe, no hospital. Nearest hospital in one of those towns was 4 hours away by dirt road. And I remember driving a guy out who lost his hand in a trim saw, and that was a tough drive. Four hours with his hand in an ice cream bucket.
It's a dark book, as I said, because it is a small town, and you know, it's almost a lawlessness. It's exploitative, especially when you talk about the people that owned, say, the sawmill. They would go in there, exploit the people, exploit the resources, and then skip town, right?
Oh, utterly. It was amazing. There's the kind of corruption that went on between, say, the government and various other social, what I would call the social industries that made a fortune out of the kind of corruption that went on in the forest industry and went on in other places. The bosses were tough, and they took money where they could get it, and the workers were utterly exploited. The man who had his hand cut off came back up to that town to see if he could get work, and the boss just said, there's no work for a guy with a hand, with only one hand, he says, and just sent him down the road, and that was that. And no one thought anything of it other than the fact that they just prayed God it wasn't going to be them next time.
The detail in the book is what really draws me into it, because I mean, I'm really feeling like I'm there. This a lot of the stuff that you write in the book are things that you observed, right?
That I what?
You observed?
Yeah. In what sense, Joe? I'm not catching.
Well, there's great detail in the book about just.
Observation.
Yeah,
the endless detail. Well, Joe, when I read a modern novel now, generally speaking, and there are great novelists in our country and around the world, of course, but they're almost exclusively driven, in many cases, by dialogue. The idea that the average reader, when they approach a page of description, they turn the page rather than read, a long description of a swamp or a long description of a street. They tire of that. They're educated by television, and they expect action all the time, and action is driven by dialogue.
Yeah.
And my delight and love of literature, the kind of novels I grew up on and was educated by people like Faulkner or Hemingway or people back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, the old masters, they taught me all about the landscape and atmosphere and the mood of a place that's driven by the kind of world they live in. And I spend my life, Lorna came out into the backyard today and told me I had to come out to the front because a butterfly was trapped up underneath a roof overlooking our porch, and I had to climb up on a ladder and get a fishnet and grab this butterfly above my head and bring it out, And that sounds like a kind of a crazy thing for an 80-year-old man to be doing, but, saving a spider or observing a grasshopper is more important to me sometimes than watching two people holding hands walking down the street.
Yeah. You talk in the book, I don't know if you talk about in the book, but you really set the setting up for the reader, just how isolating it is for them up there. Is that something that I guess you felt that when you were up there growing up, right?
Oh God, when I grew up there, when I worked up there, I mean, I grew up in the Okanagan Valley in a small town called Vernon, it was a tiny town. Used to have the biggest army camp in Canada during the Second World War. But in those small towns, the isolation was total. We could only catch radio sometimes at night. There was no television. And this was this was 1960s. There's still no television in that kind of country.
Yeah.
The newspaper came 2 days late on the train. I remember when President Kennedy was assassinated, we didn't hear about it until about 2 days later, and somebody phoned somebody and said, God, have you heard the news? Kennedy got assassinated. We said, God, no one told us.
Yeah.
We weren't connected to the world. It was an utterly self-sufficient place. It fed itself, it looked after itself, and it lived off the trains that came up out of Vancouver. People ordered their food from Woodward's in Vancouver, and it came up in boxes on the train.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically how he lived, except she shopped at the store.
Mm-hmm.
But what's lovely, I think, more than anything about those small towns, there were bad people up there, hard-assed people, but there were, in the novel, I try to explore the kind of kindnesses and the edges of history that we touch. One of the main characters, the Chinese cook, is a survivor of the massacre of Nanjing in 1937.
Mm.
And the central character of the book, I guess, Art, is a survivor of the Second World War and the plunge of the tanks from D-Day through to Germany, all of which took place really in about 6 or 8 months, and then it was over.
Mm.
And they came back with things like PTSD.
Mm.
And post-traumatic stress, and no one even knew what that was. They sometimes would call it shell shock.
Yeah.
But that had to be a pretty wrecked human being to even say that about him. Everyone had PTSD, those guys that came back, my father included.
Yeah. So you mentioned Art, and you mentioned the Chinese cook, Wang Po. They deal with this past trauma that they witnessed in different ways, don't they? In those two people in particular, when they get together, they deal with it in a particular way. I guess when they're smoking opium, I guess, right?
They smoke opium and drink alcohol.
Uh-huh.
The only drugs available in British Columbia back at that time, it was just before marijuana came to Canada.
Mm.
We used to call it Mexican tobacco, and nobody liked it very much.
Yeah.
But the basic drugs were heroin, opium, and alcohol, and those are the drugs that were available to anyone in the camps, particularly. Heroin and opium were very common. And those two men sit down together in the evening on a Saturday night or a Sunday night, and they smoke a little opium, and they drink, and they get drunk quietly, and they tell stories, or sometimes they just listen to stories mostly.
Yeah, and I guess you mentioned your father a moment ago. You and your brother, I guess, later in his life, near the end of his life, asked him about his experiences, and you told Sheila Rogers this, that he never really said anything about what happened to him until you asked him, and I guess that's the importance of it all, that you got to ask these people about their stories, right?
I think so. Everyone has a story. What's interesting about the people in this town is that dialogue is sparse, and really it doesn't occur very much. People don't have long conversations. They're working too hard. Their life is too difficult, and their conversations don't go. But usually what you would get, if you got anything, were storytelling. One of the ways men got to know men was they would tell stories about themselves, and that way you got to know who they were.
Yeah.
And women as well would tell stories about themselves. They'd sit around and storytelling would begin. And really, when we have this old anomaly of telling children bedtime stories, no one tells children bedtime stories anymore. They read to them from the books that other people write. But, I mean, when I was a kid, I couldn't wait for my father, if he talked at all, about when he was a boy, and he didn't talk about it often. And the few stories I did get from him were just rare and beautiful, the kinds of things that had happened to him back, his father and fathers back in the 19th century. You know, it's very funny now to be 80 and realize that, you know, that I'm almost a century away from where I began, which is a long, long time ago now, the beginning of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And the little towns like that don't exist anymore. That's a part of an old history that used to be. David Adams Richards writes about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I love David's writing for that. You know, he grew up the Miramichi in a harsh gravel place and think of an old poet like Alden Nowlin, who from New Brunswick, and you know, him leaving home, you know, and in scuffed boots and a new coat that his mother had sewn for him, and maids, and him walking into town and getting a job as a newspaper man when he was just a boy, you know. And I think of those kind of days. And the other thing, I guess, Joe, and I know time's running out here, but the thing I wanted to talk about more than anything was the exploitation of the companies.
Right.
And the fact that these mills, at that time in the 60s, the government of British Columbia, the old right-wing government of British Columbia at that time, mills would argue for what kind of cut blocks they would get, the kind of timber they would get to cut in their mill. And, of course, everybody wanted fir, right? They didn't want cedar because you couldn't sell it. And so what the government did was they created quotas, and they would go to a small town like Merritt, which had three sawmills, and they said, I tell you what, we look at the amount of wood you've cut over the last 5 years, and we'll guarantee you a percentage of the wood that comes out of this watershed will always be yours. You'll never have to worry about competing again. And, of course, the little guys just thought this was great. You know, they thought this was wonderful. And they were guaranteed that. And then, of course, as soon as that was done and everybody was allocated it, the large mills came in from the States and bought up the quotas, paid $1 million for a cheap little sawmill, bought a third of the watershed's timber, and thus we have the three or four companies that run BC companies today. And that was how the government worked back then.
Yeah. And that exploitation goes down to the people themselves. And I mean, in the book, the characters, you know, their interactions with women, I guess, it feeds into that, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That the treatment of women in the book, there are a couple of amazing women. You know, there's Isabel, the wife of farmer who lives up, you know, on the side hills above the town. There was another community beyond the sawmill workers and the mill people. There was also, you know, the backcountry farmers who had small holdings along the hillsides, and they, you know, made their living that way. And the wonderful old lady called Isabel, who I patterned on a woman I knew way, way back when I was a boy. And there was Molly, the wife of the foreman. And these women took charge in town, and everybody respected and really loved them. But at the same time, there were women who were deeply exploited and abused, and no one talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
A man, once he had his wife, he owned her. That was how it was back then. And everyone respected that and looked at that. You know, as long as your wife didn't walk into the store with, you know, two broken legs and a broken arm, he didn't say anything. You just murmured quietly, well, that's so-and-so, you know, he's not very good to his wife. And that's where they'd be left.
You know, Patrick, it's not an altogether pleasant time that you write about. I mean, it's a primitive time in the province, but at the same time, as I'm reading the book, I'm thinking there aren't too many books like this set where this is set.
Yeah, no, I don't think there are too many books that do this. The only other two people I could mention, Joe, are the two boys, Joel and Emerson, who were the most, for me, the two most delightful characters in the book, and the two characters I love more than anything. They reminded me very much of when I was a boy, my brothers and friends, and one of them was a little feral kid called Emerson, who I named after Lorna's father.
Oh, okay.
She was really pleased with that.
Yeah.
And just the way these boys lived, you know, these wild sort of crazed lives in these tiny towns, you know, because people didn't watch their kids 24 hours a day. They barely watched them at all. So once you could walk, you were on your own.
Yeah.
You know, go outside and play and don't come home from dinner kind of a thing. And I love kids like that. And they're delightful characters. They play central roles throughout the book, as they really are the ones who are polarizing, catch the polarizing moments as the mystery slowly unfolds.
So when you're writing these characters, Joel and Emerson in particular, do you look back at this time? Because as I said, it's a dark time. But, I mean, you look at it with some say, nostalgia, some fondness, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we had the Saturday night dances once a month were great. I mean, everybody got gussied up and dressed up, and everybody hit the floor dancing, and it was the 50s and the early 60s, and it was great rock and roll, and everybody danced their hearts out and got very, very drunk and staggered home and spent Sunday trying to get over it. And there was sweetness at the same time. There were quiet, good times amongst people and amongst families. People worked hard and tried hard, but underneath that and behind that ran this other dark world that was quite frightening. And the histories of the people themselves.
You've written a long time, Patrick. Why now? As opposed to, say, when you were a kid writing about then. I mean, I guess the passage of time makes, I don't know if it's easier, but I think your perspective is richer, that you can look at this time as well and as critically as you do in this novel. I guess you had to be in your late 70s to do this, right?
I'm glad you asked this question, because I never really started writing novels until, 15 years ago or 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing novels and after I quit drinking I'm an alcoholic and drank for many, many years, and I really could not sustain the labor of a novel. I was incapable of doing it. I wanted to write novels.
Uh-huh.
Started several back in the 50s, in the 60s and the 70s, but I couldn't finish them. It wasn't until I had quit drinking, and then I sat down and wrote a memoir, and then I said, okay, I'm going to write a novel, because I've been a poet all my life, and I decided I wanted to write one thing in each genre, but I've never written a play, but mm-hmm. I wrote one novel called Red Dog, Red Dog, which did really, really well,
yeah.
and then I wrote this one, and I got about a third of the way through it, and I gave up on it. I just walked away from it. I was tired and not up to doing it. Other things were facing me. And 4 years later, I was cleaning out my computer, you know, files.
Yeah, yeah.
One file called Miscellaneous, where you put everything.
Right.
And I saw the word novel, and I thought, Lorna was away on a trip, and I read the piece I'd written. I thought, God damn, I said, I'm going to finish this novel. And what the first part of the novel took 3 years to write, the second part of the novel took 3 months.
Mm.
And then I got a great editor who saved my life and saved the novel, Melanie Little, who I owe a great deal to. She was tough, and she was really, really, there was no escape from her. She was on the phone saying, okay, you know, do this chapter, fix that, do that, do that. And I said, okay. I've always obeyed the orders of women. I've discovered that in my life, that they have great control over me.
Yeah.
So a female editor is always the best thing for me. But
I guess you were working with her, you were quite sick at the time and couldn't really do much, but I guess it forced you to do something, right?
No, I just come out of the hospital, actually.
Uh-huh.
I had, at Christmas, my doctor gave me 10 days to live.
Yeah.
And this was the end of February or March or beginning of April, sometime like that, and they'd solved what I had and given me the medication that controlled it, and I sort of crawled out of the hospital and phoned Melanie, who they told me was going to be my new editor, because I'd had one shortly before that, Anita Jones, and she had unfortunately wasn't able to continue, and I phoned Anita, and I said, Melanie, I said, I can't finish this novel, I'm very sorry, but impossible. I said, I just got to the hospital. And she said, I've spent 100 hours on your novel. She said, you're not quitting. And I just remember putting my head in my hand and said, oh, God, I guess I have to finish it. And so I did. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I did. I'm glad I had the last paragraph of the novel written after I wrote 7 pages of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I held it off. Held that paragraph till the very end. It was the end of. I knew it was the end of the book, and I had to figure out a way to get there.
Mm.
One critic said I took too long to get there, but I could have written longer. Actually, there was so much more to explore. in their lives. Just telling the story of the escape from Nanjing, you know, of a Chinese boy, young man, or, you know, another man who witnessed a terrible crime in Holland, a Canadian soldier. I mean, those stories were stories I grew up on, you know.
Yeah.
And I wanted those stories told by men that I respected. Because in the book, I respect, I think, Wang Po and Art, the other fellow, Art Penny.
Yeah, you like these guys, don't you?
Yeah, I really, really like those guys. They're both somewhere broken, and the breaking of men is a cruel and evil thing, and war does that to people. And the other place that does that to people are small logging towns.
Mm.
Small sawmill towns break people, too. Mm. I saw people hurt really badly and live tough lives. Mm. But at the same time, there was, as I said before, there could be a lot of happiness and joy, too. People played hard, worked hard, lived hard.
Mm. What are you working on now, Patrick?
Actually, I've fallen back into another the same illness, along with another illness that's caused me to have pneumonia here recently.
Mm.
And I was in the hospital for a couple more weeks. I just got out, I guess, 3 weeks ago. So I'm not really working on a whole heck of a lot. I've decided that I began another novel, and I was writing a friend of mine, Sean Virgo, who's a wonderful writer and a good friend. And I said, I'm spending my time, I said, savagely attacking 32 pages, which I hate, and I go back to it like a dog after its own vomit, as my father would have been, and just pour over these 32 pages, you know, viciously attacking paragraphs, tearing things out and putting them back together. So I probably have another novel that has got 32 pages written, and maybe I'll finish it before I finish other things.
Are you still writing poetry?
No, actually, there's no, I'm not writing poetry at all. I wrote my last book of poetry called Washita, and published it about 3-4 years ago, a year or two before. And it's not a last book by any stretch. I have most of another manuscript prepared, but it's a book I want to live with for a while before I do another. I wanted to make poems clench so tightly they couldn't be unraveled. And succeeded. I think it was for me the work of a lifetime to write that particular book of poetry. Although God knows I wrote a lot of books, but for me that book is a very special one. So I'm not working on poetry either right now. Beyond every once in a while I dip into the manuscript that's sitting there and say, "You're not up to the last book." So.
You know, I've done this a long time. Interviewed a lot of authors over the years, and. These conversations I've had with you, and I think of the conversations as well with Lorna. I've had three with her, are some of my favorites.
Thanks, Joe. I appreciate that.
Well, as I end this chat with you, Patrick, I just want to say that I wish you what you wish for yourself, and all the best to you and Lorna.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I really appreciate that. And you take care out there. And let's all thank God that those small towns. And the people in them, we don't have that kind of stuff anymore, not to that same degree, although we have industrialized, mechanized, and technological domination in ways that just terrify me.
Yeah,
but that's another conversation.
Well, I hope we'll have more conversations over the next few years, eh?
For sure.
Yeah.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome.
The book is called Deep River Night. It's published by McClelland & Stewart. Patrick Lane joined me on the line from his home in Saanich in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.